two warnings. First of all, I am not really an expert in linguistics, and this topic is fairly new to me. This is a project which I started very recently. So I will show you some preliminary ideas, mostly numerical and simulation results rather than very rigorous results. Second thing I want to say that I will be talking about acquisition of a second language or foreign language. I will not really be talking about acquisition of a mother tongue. This is somewhat different process. Of course, there are some similarities, but acquisition of languages, of the native language in children is a bit different. So everybody who learned a foreign language has a similar kind of experience. You take your language classes, you study grammar and vocabulary, and you do it for a couple of months, and then you meet a native speaker and you realize that you really know nothing, that you don't understand a single word. Many people share that, had that kind of experience. So then you learn more and more, and when you, let's say, read a text in a newspaper, you have a feeling that you sort of understand what the text is all about, but still you are not there yet. And then the time comes when you finally get this feeling, now I can get most of what is in this text. And it always seemed to me that this is a sharp transition, that there is some sort of a phase transition or some sort of bifurcation, that this process is highly nonlinear in one place. So I started thinking about it and exploring this issue. And first, one has to, of course, answer the question, what the mechanics of the acquisition of language? How do you do that? And also, why is it so hard? That's the question which everybody is asking. So I will offer you some answers to that question. There's, of course, another question related, how to make it easier, and that, unfortunately, you won't see answer in this talk. But I will tell you why it is hard. So what is a language? Language, you can think of a language as a highly complex system consisting of two parts. There are symbols of the language, and you could look at symbols at very different level. Either those are phonemes or letters or words or sentences and so on. And there's a grammar, which is essentially just a set of rules which you use to manipulate those symbols. In the past, learning a language was mainly viewed as a matter of mastering grammar. So if you went to school, I don't know how it is in Canada, how it was in Canada, but if you went to school in other parts of the world, let's say 20 years ago, then chances are that you were tortured with grammar and spent a lot of time learning grammar. But that seems to be a thing of the past, because nowadays language acquisition specialists believe that vocabulary is much more important than grammar. And of course, you have to learn some grammar to acquire a language, but you can do it by some sort of osmosis. You know, you have to have basic understanding of grammar. However, vocabulary is much, much more important. So the next question is, how much vocabulary do you need to know to be proficient in the foreign language? Foreign language or second language, there is a slight difference between those two. We'll not get into that. So before we answer that, we have to decide what the unit of measurement. And it turns out that word is not really a good unit. Instead, linguists thought about word families. Those are usually consisting of main word, all its inflected forms, and also some derived words. For example, slow and slowly will belong to the same word family. If you know the word slow, then you will, of course, understand what slowly means. You have some basic understanding of the structure of language. Now, it has been estimated that native English speakers know around 20,000 word families. And they acquired this vocabulary, of course, in early life. And roughly speaking, one could say that you learn 1,000 words per year in early life. That is, of course, not entirely linear. It slows down later on. But that's rough estimate. Now, that number is quite high, and this is not what the learners of foreign language can realistically hope to achieve. 20,000 is quite a lot to memorize, to learn. Of course, it's a different story if you are learning a second language. So if you are, for example, an immigrant and you are immersed in a society which uses that foreign language. But if you learn foreign language just, for example, to understand scientific papers written in English, as most people have to do nowadays in other countries, then, of course, you will have hard time to learn 20,000 words, clearly. So how do you really need to know, if not 20,000? Now, the answer to that question somewhat depends on what kind of skill you want to acquire. And it turns out that reading skills and writing skills and speaking and listening comprehension, those are not entirely overlapping skills. And for each of those areas, you need a different set of skills. But we'll concentrate here on reading, because reading is easiest to assess, easiest to measure. And of course, we have huge collection of texts, so there is no shortage of data for written language. At the beginning of the 90s, two studies appeared which tried to answer that question which I'm posing here. One was done by Loifer, who is a linguist at the University of Haifa, I think, in Israel. And she studied students, acquisition of English in students, Israeli students who, of course, have to know certain level of English in order to be admitted to university. And she found that roughly 3,000 word families are needed for reading. What does it mean, needed? Well, it turns out that if you know 3,000 word families, then you will understand roughly 95% of words in a typical text she was considering. That will vary somewhat from text to text. Now, she also found that this 95% coverage is a threshold which is necessary for transferring reading skills from your native tongue to the foreign language. So if you know how to read in your native tongue, you learn 2,000 words, then you have a good chance to become proficient reader in the new language. Now, there is roughly the same time, competing study appeared by Hu and Nation. Paul Nation is another famous expert in this field, and he also measured he tried to answer the same question, and he found that this number is somewhat higher, although he considered the different texts. He considered academic texts, by that he means texts which are like university textbooks. So Human Nation found that this number is roughly 4,000 words. But there seems to be, and most linguists agree, there appears to be some sort of threshold. Of course, it's a soft threshold, not perhaps exactly 3,000 or 4,000, but somewhere between 3,000 and 5,000. Some people put it a bit higher than that. So, that's not bad, certainly less than 20,000 that I mentioned originally. Now, if we know how many, now let's attack another question. Which ones we need to learn? And that brings us back to early 30s, when American linguist George Zipf found that in a large collection of texts, there is a striking yet approximate relation between rank of a word and frequency of its occurrence. So what he did, he essentially took a large text and he ranked all words in that text. Number one is the word which is most frequent in that text. In English, that's usually some sort of functional word like and, the, a, so on. And of course, each word has a frequency, so he found that there is a power law relationship between frequency and rank. A here is a normalization constant, and this exponent Z appears to be very close to 1. Now, there's an entire different story about this exponent itself. It is not not really universal. It depends on language, but weakly. Let's say plus minus 10% typically. Also, it is different, for example, in people who have speech disorder. They have a different exponent, and this has been studied extensively. So, of course, knowing that, knowing Zipf's law, it's very natural to assume that if you want to learn a language, then you have to start with those most frequent words. That's the optimal strategy, right? You have to learn from the top of the frequency list. Learn those most useful ones first, before you learn those which are rare, right? So if we assume that learner knows K top ranking words, then the text coverage is just a sum of frequencies corresponding to those K words, top ranking K words. And if we take Zipf's law with exponent 1, then this appears to be d gamma function, which is just the derivative of gamma function, plus Euler constant. And we can expand this d gamma function. It has asymptotic expansion shown here. And the leading term is a logarithm. It turns out that in the range which we are interested in, this logarithm approximates this d gamma function quite well. So very, very roughly, I will assume that this coverage should be almost proportional to the logarithm. Now, if we say that that the text coverage is linear function of the logarithm of vocabulary size, this is really bad, right? From the point of view of a learner, because it means that it requires exponentially growing effort to keep the coverage increasing at a constant rate. I mean, you make progress at the beginning, but later on, you have to put more and more effort to increase the text coverage. Now, it turns out that in reality, that's even worse than that, because Zipf's law appears to hold only up to about 4,000 words. And beyond that, it has a different shape. And when you produce a plot of coverage, of text coverage, as a function of vocabulary size, those are squares here. This is taken from a standard reference work in that field from American Heritage Word Frequency book. And you will see that it sort of makes a turn here. It departs from the straight line. The straight line here is a logarithmic function because this is a semi-logarithmic plot. And it's very interesting that it happens at roughly the same place, right, where the linguistic threshold is located. Now, there are some reasons behind that, which I would like to explain now. Namely, Zipf originally studied those frequencies of words for fairly small sizes of vocabulary, certainly not beyond 4,000 words. And it really is hard to go beyond several thousand words, because if you take a book, for example, and you will see that most words in the book appear once. I mean, those rare words, they appear only once, so the frequency is the same for those low frequency words. So you need really huge, huge text in order to get a good view of this frequency rank distribution. And Montemura, a couple of years ago, studied exactly that problem. It took a large collection of books, over 2,600 books. Nowadays, it's easy because there are repositories of non-copyrighted books on the web. One of those is Project Gutenberg, where you have thousands of books. So he did that, and he found that up to roughly 4,000 words, Zipf's law holds really well. But above the limit, there is very different behavior. There seems to be another power law with different exponent, which is much higher. Here's how it works. This is actually reproduced from the paper of Montemuro. So as you can see, here initially, if you neglect this initial transient sort of period, then you have a good fit for a straight line with slope 1.05, so it's slightly larger than 1. And then beyond, we have this other power law, but you know, this is not entirely convincing that this is indeed a straight line. Maybe it's just as a curve. So we know that something happens, but it's kind of hard to probe into that region because we would require huge, huge collections of text. This is probably already at the limit what can be done currently. So some sort of structural change seems to take place at this level of somewhere between 3,000 and 5,000 words. And the question is, why is it significant for learning? So my idea is, my preliminary idea is that it can be explained somewhat perhaps in terms of self-hosting. This is a term which is borrowed from computer science. In the theory of computer languages, compiler of a language is self-hosting if it can be natively implemented in its own language. So if the compiler can compile its own code, it is self-hosting. And surprisingly, size of such self-hosted compiler is really small. There are examples of compilers for the language C. You can find it on the web. The smallest one, which I am aware of, consists of only 446 lines of code. So such compiler can be small. Now, can we somewhat relate that to human languages? So here's my idea how to do that. When you learn a language, then of course at the beginning you have to use a bilingual dictionary, French, English, German, English, whatever, right? But at some point you reach a level where you find that English dictionary is more useful than those bilingual dictionaries, because bilingual dictionaries are never very accurate. You know, there is never exact overlap between meaning of two words in two different languages. It's always, you know, only partially overlapping. So single language dictionaries, like for example Oxford English Dictionary or others, are more useful. So it seems that you are able to use such single language dictionary only when definitions in the dictionary, which are explained, of course, using other words, can be understood by you, right? So you have to have certain rich enough vocabulary to understand definitions, right? And then your language is sort of self-hosting, right? So to explore this idea, together with a student of mine, Colin Phipps, we used one of the dictionaries which is freely available on the internet. It's also from Project Gutenberg. It is a Webster's dictionary. It's kind of old edition from, I think, 1920s, but it's still good enough. Of course, some modern words are missing, some technology-related words are missing from it, but it is freely available. Now, so what we did, we converted that dictionary to a large graph, where vertices of the graph represent individual words, and two words are linked if one appears in the definition of the other word. Right? So the link means that one word appears in the definition of other in that dictionary. So this is a huge graph. It's a huge graph. It has 100,000 vertices. This is roughly the number of terms in this, number of words in this dictionary, and about a million edges. Now this graph has an interesting distribution, edge distribution. So here is the degree versus number of vertices which have the degree. Degree is just the number of links attached to a given vertex. And again, as you can see, there is a power law here, because this is a logarithmic plot and both axes are logarithmic. There seems to be a power law which holds in quite a significant portion of this distribution. Then, of course, here what you see here is essentially lack of sufficient data. So this is not to be trusted. So what's the dynamics? What about dynamics? Why I call it dynamical system? Dynamics here is very simple. This is one of those systems where topology of the safe space is extremely complicated. The dynamical rule itself is kind of trivial. Well, we'll simply assume that person learning English knows only a subset of words represented by the graph G. And we'll assume that one learns words starting from the most frequent one, going down the list, as I said before. With certain constant rate, or not constant, it doesn't matter. Now, the set of k top-ranking words will be denoted by W of k, and we'll construct a subgraph generated by this set of vertices. We'll call it GWK, where k increases. Once you learn new words, this graph grows. So it's nothing else but just growth process on the graph. Growing graph. So how to... of course, as I said, this is a system with a huge number of degrees of freedom, so we would like to sort of project that on some lower dimensional subspace. And there are various topological measures for graphs like that. Many of them have been developed in the last few years, last decade or so, where interest in complex networks picked up. One of such well-known measures is so-called local clustering coefficient, which is defined simply as a number of edges between neighbors of vertex V divided by number of all possible connections between those neighbors, which happen to be degree of V choose 2. All right? So it's the proportion of existing links between neighbors of V among all possible, theoretically possible links. Now then, once we have that definition, we can average that over all vertices of the graph, and we will get a single number, which is called clustering coefficient of the graph. So we looked at dependence of this clustering coefficient on the number of words, so you can think of this as time dependence, essentially, right? Because k increases with time, so k is like time. By k here, I mean number of words you know. And what you can do to visualize it, you can, for example, plot clustering at k plus 1 versus clustering at k. And that's what I show on the next slide. However, here, the step is not one word, but 500. So this is clustering at k plus 500 versus clustering at k. So we start, of course, farther, but time progresses in this direction. So you are first here and here and here. And you learn 500 words and you move along this curve. And what you can see is that initially the clustering coefficient decreases. It goes down. And something dramatic, quite dramatic, happens when you reach that time of, size of the subgraph equal to about 4,000 words. Then it makes a turn and it starts growing again. Right? So it is quite striking phenomenon, especially since this happens at the same place where we have the linguistic threshold and where we have a crossover in the zip diagram from one power law to the other. And that means the clustering coefficient first decreases with the growing vocabulary. When you reach 4,000 words, trend reverses and it starts increasing again. So we'll call this point where that happens a clustering threshold, TC. And again, it's around 4,000 words. So the question is why? Why do we see all of that? Well, here is my attempt of explaining what happens. When you start learning a language, you learn new words, and those words are located in a sort of a semantic space of meaning, I like to call it. And you first probe different areas of that space, right? And of course, that means that at the beginning, words will be fairly far away from each other in terms of meaning. So they won't be really connected. Now, when the clustering threshold is reached, that means that the semantic space is pretty much covered with words, and you just start adding words with no longer discover new areas, but rather they end up in the proximity of previously known words. So then you start increasing clustering coefficient. So reaching that threshold is somewhat equivalent to covering all important areas of your face space, of your semantic space. And that's why, perhaps, we see this sudden change in understanding, right? Because once you cover the space of meaning, you have large enough vocabulary to understand text. And what happens after that, you only sort of refine it, you know, you learn more specialized words. And of course, the remarkable fact is that those three thresholds which are defined, they appear roughly at the same place, even though they don't seem to be very directly linked. So there is certainly some sort of structural change in the graph at the level of 4,000 words. What exactly is that? Unfortunately, I cannot say at the moment. One thing which we did, however, we tried to model this graph with random graph, essentially. There are many random graph models, and we tried many of them. And it appears that there is one particular model which seems to be working well. This is a configuration model. Not really enter into details of definition of that. But it appears that it exhibits similar behavior of clustering coefficient if you assume that the degree distribution is parallel. We almost have a proof of that. It has some details to be worked out, but it seems the configuration model can reproduce that behavior, but of course that's only a partial explanation. So we also want to gather more evidence to see, for example, if that happens in other languages. The main difficulty is it's not so easy to get electronic version of a dictionary which wouldn't have some strings attached, copyright and so on. So, but we are negotiating that, and it seems like we will get at least Polish and French dictionaries very soon. And we'll see if that happens also in those two languages. There's also another angle to it. This dictionary which we used is perhaps not the best one to try that idea on. Perhaps these hours would be better, and again, that's something which we are doing now. There is a 3 hours which is freely available, and we'll try to measure clustering coefficient for it. There's also one very interesting database. It's called WordNet. This is a database of synonyms, hypernyms, and hyponyms. Those are essentially words which are less general, more general than a given word. And preliminary results for that database, we started working on that, seem to indicate that, again, there is a similar effect, a little bit higher than at 4,000, but it seems that clustering coefficient for that database has a minimum at roughly 4,500. So, which, of course, is okay. That I treat this as a confirmation of this, because those thresholds are not sharp. It's clear that they somewhat depend on text, that they will somewhat depend on type of text, of course, and language, presumably. But I hope that at least is partially convincing that there is some threshold, and it certainly deserves further investigation. Thank you.